Hello, everyone, and welcome to Few and Far Between, conversations about rare disease research. I'm your host, Wayne Bowden. On today's podcast, I will be talking with Marianne Clancy. Marianne is the executive director at Cure HHT. For those of you who don't know what HHT is, you will hear me stumble over the meaning of the acronym Hereditary Hemorrhagic Telangiectasia. It's actually a rare vascular disorder that affects around 1.5 million people, or patients, I should say, worldwide. The company Cure HHT was actually founded to advocate for patients and their families with this disease, raise awareness for HHT, and also guide and fund clinical research in the field. And the Cure HHT Treatment Centers for Multidisciplinary Excellence have actually grown from just 7 to 25 in North America alone during Marianne's tenure there. And it's really been a model for other uncommon and rare diseases advocacy organizations. So Marianne is actually really well positioned at Cure HHT. She actually has the disease HHT herself. In the early 2000s, she was able to attain a release of the patents of the two most common HHT genes, which led to the availability of genetic testing in North America
and broader diagnosis of the disease.
She's also led the launch of Cure HHT's first research funding program, leveraging over $1 million of investments in seed grants to over $34 million in research grants from the NIH and FDA and other federal agencies here in North America, as well as in Europe.
During our conversation, we talked about her personal experience with HHT and how that affected her mission, how Cure HHT is forwarding the search for a cure through not only advocacy, but also through clinical research, which they're conducting currently. We also talked about the broader implications of their unique model of advocacy and where rare disease research is heading to into the future. So it was a really satisfying discussion, and I hope that you all enjoyed as much as I enjoyed speaking with Marianne. And without further ado, let's get into my discussion with Marianne now.
All right. I'm here with Marianne Clancy. Marianne, welcome to the Few and Far Between podcast.
Thank you, Wayne. It's a great opportunity. I appreciate it.
It's good to have you. So we're obviously here to talk about cats. No, I'm just kidding. We've actually brought you here to talk about a genetic disease called hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia, or HHT. Thank God they gave that a nice, easy acronym. So this is actually a disease, for the listeners, a rare disease that is characterized by malformations, as I understand it, of the patient's arteries and veins, particularly the connections between them where a capillary should be. And, you know, I admit that a week ago, I did not know how to say this disease. And a year ago, before I actually met your company, Cure HHT, Marianne, I hadn't even heard of HHT. So I had only just learned of this rare disease a year ago upon meeting some of your associates and colleagues at Cure HHT. So for the listeners, maybe it'd be best to start with just a little bit about, you know, what HHT is and, you know, how it really affects patients and their families. And then we can talk about all the amazing work that you're doing there at Cure HHT.
Certainly. And Wayne, you really got the pronunciation correct. Wow, I'm very
good practice. Thank you.
So thank goodness. So HHT, hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia, was discovered and noted literally in the late 1800s. So it's been around a long time, and I'm not surprised that you haven't heard about it, because it's been a neglected disease. And basically, HHT is a genetic blood vessel disease in which malformations in the blood vessels occur where there should be a capillary between arteries and veins. It's either missing or very fragile. And if you think of your body, you have blood vessels all throughout your body and in your organs. So in HHT, these vascular malformations is what we call them, can occur in several organs of the body, such as the nose. So the most common manifestation are nosebleeds in the family. Now, when you think about nosebleeds, you know, people get them, you grow out of them as a child, many people do. But if they're in your family, there's something else going on. And these nosebleeds, these vascular malformations in the nose resulting in nosebleed can range from something bothersome, you know, a few times a week, maybe, to very, very serious, lasting an hour or two, leading to transfusion dependence. So it can be very, very serious. So those malformations in the smaller vessel are called telangiectasia, and that's why in the smaller vessels, it's the nose and the gastrointestinal tract. So that's the chronic bleeding problem. In fact, HHT is the second most common genetic disease to cause bleeding.
Wow.
More common than hemophilia, which most people have heard of. There's nothing wrong with the blood, it's the vessels. So when these malformations are in the larger vessels, such as the lung, the brain, the liver, they can rupture. So what happens is if it's in the brain, basically they can rupture, leading to a catastrophic circumstance, which unfortunately is all too common with our population. So it can lead to sudden death, disability, because these are literally ticking time bombs. In the lung, these malformations occur in about half of our patients. That patients generally feel short of breath. They're misdiagnosed as asthma. I know many, many people that have been on asthma medication for 25 years, but it's really these malformations don't give you enough oxygen. You're on the sports field, you can't catch your breath. But no one's putting the pieces together that nosebleeds, shortness of breath, or a stroke could lead to something serious. And lastly, in the liver, these malformations occur generally when people are a little bit older, in their fourth and fifth decade of life. And that shunts blood, causing the heart to work harder, and people go into high output cardiac failure. So it's a very complex disease. By which there's a very acute problem with sudden rupture that could be devastating, and a chronic piece of the bleeding that gets worse with age.
I think I read, it may have been in one of your pieces, that this disease is called the Great Masquerader.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, because like you said, there's so many pieces of it that are chronic and not seriously life-threatening, right? Like you mentioned nosebleeds, which is interesting. Like we all have had nosebleeds probably at one point in our life. We all have known people who are prone to having nosebleeds. And what you're saying is that, you know, for those people who are prone to having nosebleeds, if like one of the key telltale signs that there might be HHT in that family line is if other people in their family also have or are prone to having nosebleeds. Is that right?
Absolutely. And interestingly about that is when you diagnose one patient with HHT, you generally diagnose a whole family.
Yeah.
So some of our families, we have 200 family members affected, 400, you know, different towns across the country. So you might not be the most popular person at the family reunion when you get this diagnosis, but it's really critical because people are really at risk if they don't know. And what's also important to understand is this is very treatable. So those tragedies of sudden death due to brain or lung hemorrhage can be prevented because you can be treated once you're screened. And I think one of the pieces that you, or one of the educational pieces that we put together that you read about the Great Masquerader, is that the lag to diagnosis. There was a study done in Europe that looked at 20 different diseases across the country. And I want to say that HHT, I like to call it common rare disease, because it affects about 1 in 5,000 people. Wow. So that's 1.5 million people globally. And the key about this is, and hopefully for your audience, is that 85% of patients are not yet diagnosed.
Yeah.
Only 15% are. And the lag from symptoms such as a nosebleed to diagnosis is 27 years.
Wow. So people could actually go their whole lives and potentially even die, not ever knowing. And potentially they could even die from complications of HHT that got attributed then to something else, right?
Absolutely.
You know, you have a hemorrhage or something in your brain or your liver, and, you know, they didn't think to ever make a genetic test, and they think it's just potentially something old age or related. And you'd never known their whole life that you had this disease that could have, you know, you could have treated and then maybe not even had that terrible result.
Correct.
Interesting. So you said 1 in 5,000. That's about, if I remember correctly, that's about the same as something like cystic fibrosis. I mean, everybody knows cystic fibrosis.
Correct.
And yet, you know, this disease just doesn't get as much of the limelight. So before we kind of get into what you're doing to bring it into the limelight, because it is a serious problem. It's affecting, like you said, 70,000 Americans and millions of people worldwide, or hundreds of thousands or worldwide, I guess I should say. the etiology of this disease is genetic. And as I understand it, there's actually multiple genes, right? There's like 3 to 5 genes that can cause this disease. I want to talk about this because I know that you have done a lot of work to actually get these genes released from some patents so that we could actually diagnose this disease. So maybe let's get into the genetics of it, of the disease and the treatments and what you've done yourself and with your colleagues to actually make this serious condition diagnosable.
Absolutely. Thank you. So yes, HHT, the genes were diagnosed in the early 90s, and HHT is an autosomal dominant disease. So that means that it doesn't skip generations. So every child that's born to a parent with HHT has a 50-50 chance. And some families may have 4 children and all 4 of them have it. Some families may have children that escape the diagnosis. It's just a luck of the dice, really, roll of the dice, I should say. And so it may seem in some families that it skips generations because it affects people differently. So your mother could have horrendous nosebleeds and her son and daughter, not really a whole lot, but could have internal manifestations that are going on. So there were 2 primary genes, endoglin and ACVRL1, formerly known as ALK, that basically count toward about 90% of all HHT. In the around 2000, another gene was found, SMAD4, and that's a combination syndrome of juvenile polyposis, in which children get precancerous polyps, and HHT. And that's a very small segment. So, and then there are 2 additional genes we think that are out there that may count for, you know, the remaining 6%. But we know the majority of patients will either test for endoglin or ALK. And every family has their own mutation, their own fingerprint. So in my family, I have HHT and I'm endoglin. So for every family member, I could have 2nd, 3rd, 4th cousins, they would have their DNA tested against the family mutation.
And these genes, they code for like transformational growth factors, right? Yes. Are they all TGF?
Yes. TGF-beta, yes. So it's a VEGF. We have too much VEGF. So again, it does code for TGF-beta. It's very complex in terms of its pathways.
Yeah, that protein's in a lot of things. Yes. But I'm curious, are the homozygous individuals more severe than the heterozygous? That's interesting. Okay. So it is, a dominant sort of loss of function or sort of gain of function potentially.
Yeah, it's a haploinsufficiency. Okay. So it's loss of the protein in endoglin and ALK.
Okay. So from there, maybe you can talk a little about how your career, reading about it, it was very organic, right? I mean, you mentioned yourself, like you are a patient of this. You found out very late in your life, as I understand. You weren't diagnosed as a child, and yet your growth, you know, into this field, learning that you had the disease and then working with your own physician to help and grow, you know, this business and get these patents on these genes released. Maybe you can talk a little about, you know, what you did there.
I like to say that, you know, this is definitely not a position somebody dreams about doing, being executive director of a rare disease foundation. So I was living my life happily. I did lose a sister when I was a year and a half old. It was 1959. She was only 14, died very suddenly. And it was attributable to walking pneumonia. And then just 6 years later, my brother was diagnosed with, they thought he had TB and isolated him. And it turned out to be an AVM in his lung. And that's when we heard the first diagnosis of what HHT is also known of as Osler-Weber-Rondeau syndrome, after 3 physicians who discovered it.
For the listeners, AVM is an arteriovenous malformation. This is the issues that are caused by the genetic disease.
Right. So he had his lung, partial lobe of his lung removed, hospitalized for a few months. I had a cousin who a few months later was in college, got a lung hemorrhage while he was shaving. He was airlifted to the same hospital in Philadelphia, same surgeon my brother had. And then the whole family started having this. So, you know, times went on. My mother had horrendous nosebleeds every day of her life. She was chronically anemic. And I had nosebleeds. And I was off to college, doing well, but still having nosebleeds. And then I was living in Boston at the time. We got married. We were thinking of having children. And I thought, you know, I might want to go and talk to a hematologist because this is in the family. So I went to the top person. And he went in at Harvard, actually. And I was referred there. And I walked in with this incredible family history and significant nosebleeds. And he tested me for a platelet disease and said, you don't have this, don't worry about it. So I went from there. Then we moved to Virginia, Washington, D.C. I was tested there, was told I didn't have it. Then I moved to Dallas. And at that point, I was told I didn't have it. And ironically, my brother's son was exhibiting symptoms and was turning blue on the basketball court. And so we were able to find the world expert, who at the time was at Yale. And I had just had, back in the day, you had your physicals and you had a chest x-ray, and FedEx did. He took a look at them and said, nope, she has to get up here and see me. So I was diagnosed after having three children. Thank goodness that I didn't hemorrhage or have a significant event, because women that are pregnant, you double your blood volume.
Yeah.
So if you have lung AVMs, we lose women and babies when they're pregnant if they don't know that they have this.
Yeah.
And so for me, I'm just thankful nothing happened, because I did have lung AVMs, big enough to be treated. Wow. So I was asked to join the board of directors because I had a background in, actually back then, dentistry, and I was in academia, and then I worked in corporate. So I joined the board and wanted to help spread awareness. And when you're newly diagnosed, you're going to do anything and everything. And my children were all tested because the genes were patented. So every person that was diagnosed, if you had your children, you get a brain MRI right at birth, because too many children die due to these brain AVMs that they have early in their life, and CAT scans of the lungs. And one of the issues for me when I was on the board and became volunteer president, I was about ready to go back to my job, and they asked me to stay on, become the first ED, executive director. So my mission was, we have these genes and they're patented. And in Europe, you're not allowed to patent genes. So I set up a task force and focused like a laser.
Yeah. And this was like what time period? Because obviously now, I believe finally in the US as well, it is against a lot of patent genes, but that was only changed, I believe, like in the past 5 or 10 years. But this was back in the early 2000s, correct?
Correct. It was 2001, 2002. And so I got a task force together, saw a patent attorney, and we were able to talk with both of the researchers, eventually basically release the patents. And upon releasing those patents, you know, we worked collaboratively with them. We're a very collaborative community, but we really needed to focus on it. And we provided three small grants to start up genetic testing, two in the United States and one in Canada. So now patients, and especially young children, aren't getting brain MRIs and CAT scans, because if you test negatively, you're done. If you test positively, then you go to the next step of a brain MRI.
I see. So the patent release was really able to just expand the access for diagnostics, right? So before they had to go to only one institution to get diagnosed, but now, you know, with your help, and actually it sounds like you guys were doing testing yourselves, you know, more and more patients could actually get tested and find out if they had the disease, right?
Correct. Yes.
Well, that's really great. So maybe take us now from, you know, back in the early 2000s and you're starting up QHHT to where you are now. You know, I mean, you have multiple treatments now that you guys are funding, you know, that are in clinic, that have shown efficacy, you know, for treating this disease. So maybe you can walk us through some of the treatments that you're exploring right now, what the company is doing, and most importantly, you know, how is it helping other HHT patients?
Absolutely. So before we even started with exploring different therapeutics, we started expanding our treatment centers of excellence because it really takes a team of multidiscipline professionals that understand this. So we went from, you know, three centers of excellence in 1996 to 23 in the United States and additional five in Canada. And most of the treatments had been interventional. So by that, I mean, so again, when you have brain and lung, you're going in with plugs and coils and sealing off those arteries so they don't rupture. But when you're talking about nosebleeds and GI bleeding, you were going in, you basically, the treatment of choice was cautery or laser or some surgical treatments. And more than a decade ago, a number of our board members, as well as myself, really felt that we needed to be in the 21st century and move and look toward therapeutics. And at the same time, the FDA was very interested, became more interested, and companies became more interested in rare disease and had certain benefits. So the key was really to tag on to that and look at that whole pathway and look at the types of therapies that might be effective. And it was happenstance, really, because we had a patient who was being treated for cancer that was put on bevacizumab, known as Avastin, and her nosebleed stopped, her GI bleeding stopped, she wasn't anemic anymore, feeling really well. And we thought, wow, this, we really should be looking at this. So a few studies were done on Avastin and now biosimilars. And then we looked at, as our research grew, we continued to invest in research and young investigators. We invested about $2 million that had been leveraged to $35 million, which is really great ROI. And all of our funding, we don't have federal funding. All of our funding is from patients, donations. We were very strategic about how we invested in the best research wherever they were around the world. And we were able to look at these pathways and see some therapeutics, such as a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And one of our board members has HHT in his family, was also at GlaxoSmithKline. And he's primarily the person that's responsible for helping get a study funded at Glaxo and the actually at GSK, and the patients did extremely well at a low dose, 50 milligrams, and whereas the cancer dose is 800 milligrams.
This is of bevacizumab.
This is pazopanib.
Oh, pazopanib.
Pazopanib. Okay. And so pazopanib was a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and it's a VEGF blockade. So its mechanism is a bit different than bevacizumab. We think it's more effective. Avastin is, and bevacizumab has helped a lot of patients. Some patients it may not work on, but it's done wonders. We thought perhaps this VEGF blockade, pazopanib, might really help as well. And it's a pill versus with bevacizumab, it's IV infusion. So we were really thrilled with the response that we got. And so, long story short, the oncology portfolio was sold to Vardis, another company, and so our trial was stopped, our proof of concept trial. But patients that were on this, the nine that completed the study, and the study's been published in Angiogenesis, haven't stopped taking it because their life changed. They weren't getting infusions. They weren't getting blood transfusions. Their quality of life was so much better, and said, I will never get off this drug. And so they're monitored. We haven't seen the side effects because the dose is low. And that's not to say there won't be any if we go to a large trial, which is what we're going to be doing later this fall. But we decided that if we didn't do this and invest in this type of treatment and therapeutics, no one would. So our board made a decision to invest in the generic form of the drug. We found a manufacturer. We had submitted an IND to the FDA, which was approved. We also got a breakthrough designation from the FDA all within the last 6 months. So
congrats.
It's really been, and we knew we're taking a risk. We're a small organization. We don't have tens of millions of dollars, but we really have seen that patients have been really benefiting from physicians who are prescribing this drug off-label, repurposed at a low dose, 50 to 100 milligrams in some very ill patients that were literally not going to survive. They started at 200 milligrams and dosed down and totally had reversal. So we're hopeful.
Well, I think it's amazing that the organizational structure that you have and the funding structure, you know, being funded entirely by patients, that's very unique. CureHHT, you're funded directly by patients, you know, doing the research directly for patients, which is amazing. I guess my question is, like, is the future of CureHHT to become a pharmaceutical company or, you know, or
good
something
question.
Else? Yeah.
We're not there yet. So we are really fortunate to have such a robust, wonderful scientific and medical community globally. And we collaborate. We've been holding scientific meetings, and they started way back in 1996, every other year. Started with 60 people, and now there are over 200 at our last meeting. And so that's the million-dollar question, right? So we did this. We don't have any partners. I would love to have pharma and biotech partners, but no one stepped forward, and we weren't going to wait. We have a lot of passionate people, smart people who said, we're going to dig in, we're going to do this. So we are proceeding with the clinical trial at 10 sites later this year at our 10 centers that will be geographically dispersed in the United States. We don't think that we're going to become a pharma company.
but once those results come out, then you'll see people
right.
lining up at the door.
Right? Could be. But, you know, we've been able to outsource the CRO, as you know, with BioRacy and a manufacturer of generics that do this and have a very good track record. We did a PK study. And I would say none of this would be possible without, and I'm going to mention his name, Dennis Sprecher, who's an incredible individual who's helped us tremendously make this happen. Mm-hmm. Because without him, we wouldn't be doing this because of his pharma expertise and his role at GSK and getting some help with all of this. So, and he's been volunteering all of this time. He's not being paid. However, we want help for our families and we want it now. Mm-hmm. So we might be looking at partnerships, you know, once this clinical trial is underway. We're still mapping out our business strategy.
Yeah, I'm very hopeful. Wanted to wish you guys good luck on all this. And
thanks.
What we can do to help, we will, obviously, with the clinical trial. You know, I've also met Dennis, and he is a super passionate and knowledgeable guy. So it's great that he's on board as well. Wanted to ask, you know, the fact that these drugs are available in their generic forms, both pazopanib as well as bevacizumab, are these being prescribed off-label by docs?
Yes.
So they do prescribe.
They are.
Okay.
And it's been hard. The reimbursement is difficult.
Right.
We have our docs appealing to get them reimbursed. The pazopanib drug comes off patent, I believe, in 2023.
Oh, right.
There are several biosimilars with bevacizumab now. And so, again, these are just two therapies in the arsenal. We think that we'll be looking for additional therapies, maybe combinations of therapies as things move forward, because the goal is really to get at the problem rather than ameliorate the symptom. It's really vascular, and to be able to shrink these AVMs and reverse them, prevent them from forming in the first place. And we've seen with bevacizumab how the vessels shrink in the nose to be able to, and the telangiectasia on the face and hands go away with treatment. But again, we don't know what the maintenance dose is. Again, all of this requires study and money. We've now invested what we can, and we were so thrilled to get this funding for this clinical trial.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Because we wouldn't be able to move forward without it.
Timeline-wise, I mean, what is the, you know, sort of best case or maybe just likely case scenario for when patients might be able to see one of these drugs like on the market?
So our goal is to have this approved by the FDA. So we are working in tandem in working on the study. We hope to launch this study late this fall. And at the same time, we're working in tandem with the FDA to get approval. So I would say I'm hoping that by the time we can recruit robustly, there's no shortage of patients. But again, people really want to get help now. Could be 2 years. 3 years if we could get approval through the FDA, and that's the whole point. Our patients are so engaged. I will tell you, Wayne, that when we put out a survey on epistaxis, on nosebleeds, in the first 2 hours, we had the server shut down. We had 800 people responding.
Wow.
It was crazy.
Yes, they're out there. I think you were in a special place, right? Because, I mean, BioRassi, as you know, runs a lot of rare disease trials. Yeah. And in most cases, we are obviously working with pharma. We just talked about, you know, most of the pharma is partnering with different groups or pursuing their own piece. And therefore, you know, we really do a lot of work at the beginning of the studies to identify the advocacy groups, identify the patient, you know, communities, trying to find the patients, right? Just because, you know, if you just start a study or start a site, you're going to be just twiddling your thumbs for, you know, many, many months before a patient strolls into the door. You have to do the upfront work with rare diseases. But it feels like you guys are, CureHHT is a very different position, having really kind of built this patient community yourself. I mean, you were one of the only ones diagnosing patients. So how is that going to make the operational execution of this trial so much easier?
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because the first trial that we funded was a bevacizumab with tranexamic acid, estrogen. It was a spray against placebo. And it was our 6 centers, and that's also been written up in JAMA. We have an educated population and have worked really closely with them to recruit. And we use lots of different engagement mechanisms with them. We also are part of an NIH consortia specific to brain malformations. We're a recruiting site. ACURE-HHT is. It's an observational study. It's not a clinical trial. We are involved in another clinical trial. Our efforts at recruitment really are, I think, we're in a unique position because we are on the front line. We educate, we refer patients to centers, we understand their journey. And again, what we try to do is get them into understanding why research is so important and how participating in research is critical to alleviating this. And if their children are affected, people will move heaven and earth. They don't want to see their children going through what their grandparents went through, great-grandparents, etc. So we are also very fortunate to get a Rare as One grant through this Chan Zuckerberg Initiative and have a very focused approach on an international research network, and it's patient-led. So we have about 10,000 patients in our database, and we're very active. We run webinars. We sponsored a clinical guidelines conference. It was just the standards have just been written up into the publication in the Annals of Internal Medicine in September of 2020. Patients were part of that. So patients in the HHT community, patients are partners. And it's not just lip service. We're at the table when we're talking clinical endpoints, when we're talking about recruitment strategy. So I truly feel that there's respect on both sides. I think that's why we're so...
Oh, and there has to be. I mean, you yourself are the living embodiment of the partnership between patients and CureHHT. You mentioned that there are 10,000 patients in your database. Is that around the U.S. or even around the world? Are you just focused on the U.S. right now, or are there any plans to look?
No, that's internationally. And one of the interesting aspects, Wayne, is I've been here for a while, right? 20 years. I never thought I would be. And the number of people contacting us per year hasn't changed. We have about 800 new people contacting us every year.
You're just starting to get into the meat there of all the patients.
Right.
Yeah. And one, I think, interesting, or I would say really intriguing thing and beneficial thing about, you know, you guys running trials is that that seems to me to be a perfect venue to get the word out about this trial, engaging, like you said, in educating the patient community, people who don't know their patients, right? People who are part of the patient community may not even know that they're part of the patient community through the advertising through outreach from your own network to say, hey, are you experiencing these types of symptoms in, with yourself and with your family members? And if so, it's not just that, hey, go get diagnosed and there's nothing for you. It's, if so, we have something that can actually help. You know, you can join this trial and you could actually see, you know, your telangiectasia disappear potentially.
What's amazing is we have over 8,000 people on social media globally. We do webinars, several of them, for patients so they understand what we're trying to achieve, what the risks are, what the benefits are. We've done surveys. We did recently a needs survey for research and priorities. We're beginning to set a strategic research plan for the next 5 years. We had 1,200 patients respond in a matter of 2 weeks.
That's amazing.
So it's amazing. But trying now to go through some of the open-ended responses is taking a long time. But they just want to live a normal life.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? That's giving credence to the fact that, like you said, this is one of the more common rare diseases. It really deserves to have more of a spotlight shining on it because it affects so many of us and so many of our families. One of the things that strikes me as so interesting about CureHHT, which I mentioned before, is like just the model of your company and how you started with diagnosing patients, now actually pioneering and funding, you know, treatments for those patients. You know, so it's a very non-pharma type of, you know, approach. What advice do you have for others that are in this space that might be trying to do something similar with maybe a different rare disease, having gone through it yourself?
Well, you know, again, we had to be resourceful because we didn't have any partners. My advice is raising money, first of all, for therapies was critical. We basically said, look, we're not going to wait another 10 years for this. We need therapeutics. And so we're going to invest some of your top medical people, physicians treating, scientists working in the lab, as well as looking at high throughput screening and working together. You can break the paradigm a bit, and maybe people will jump on board and become partners with you. And we're hopeful that we'll have partners in the future. It would be a lot less expensive, but you know, we made the early investments.
Yeah, it's clear that those are paying off. I mean, it's it's clear that you had, like you said, took some risks kind of going out on your own when you couldn't immediately find that partner. But from everything that you've accomplished so far and, you know, these upcoming accomplishments that we're planning, it's really an amazing journey. You know, I think that your passion shows, and I don't think there's anything that's going to stop you. I appreciate it both ways and really respect the work that you guys are doing and hope that we can do our part to help. And thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about HHT.
Please go to our website, and I look forward to our work together. And I really can't thank you enough for this opportunity. I hope we can reach people who may need us.
Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you, Wayne.
If you enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes and how we can make it better, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorassi.com or contact us at our website at biorassi.com.